God, thank you so much for all you do for us. Thank you for this day, which I'm sure has been productive for everyone here in some way. God, thank you for this evening where we get to join together and think and learn about things that are important to this world and important to your dominion over it. God, thank you for like-minded people that we can join together with and enjoy community. God, thanks for our speaker, Nate, and we pray that you would bless his thoughts and his words as he speaks to us tonight. God, we just ask that everything we do and say in this evening would be mindful of you and empowered and oriented towards your kingdom in some way. God, we thank you for all these things, and we ask in Christ's name. Amen.
So Jane DeBonney is the person who had the initial idea to invite Nate, so she's going to...
Good evening. As you said, I'm Jane DeBonney. I'm on the planning committee for the local ASA chapter here. And you might wonder sometimes how it is that we come up with these topics and these speakers. So I thought I'd give you some of the backstory for tonight's topic and speaker. I teach biology at College of DuPage. And last summer, my section canceled due to low enrollment. It's kind of bad because then I didn't get paid, but the good news is I had the summer off. So last summer, for the first time, another thing that happened was our family bought vegetables from a CSA called the Green Earth Institute. It's in South Naperville. And CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And this is where you buy a share in the farm's production for that year. And they've really been growing in popularity in the last 20 years. So we prepaid in January for our vegetables that would be grown in the upcoming season. And so from June to October, picking up the vegetables at that farm where they were grown was an enjoyable errand for me. And each time I would gather my share of ultra-fresh, highly nutritious, organically grown vegetables. And then learning to prepare and serve these vegetables with meals really expanded my culinary horizons. And I actually felt healthier than ever. This experience piqued my interest in how food is produced. And since I had the summer off, I started reading everything I could find at the local library on better ways to raise food, both animal and vegetable food. And this quest led to my suggestion on the planning committee that we include better food production as one of our topics this year. One thing led to another, and soon we learned of a really interesting multifaceted farm in Elburn, Illinois. It's called the Heritage Prairie Farm. And that's where tonight's speaker, Nate Sumner, is the operations manager. Nate Sumner is a Wheaton native with personal ties to this college community. He studied and worked in the culinary arts in San Francisco, and there, through interactions with some of the most innovative small-scale farmers in the country, he realized that growing food rather than cooking it was his true calling. Next, he interned at the Green Earth Institute, and then he was employed at the Heritage Prairie Farm. So we are very eager to hear Nate speak on revolutionary food production, techniques for the future from the past. So please meet and welcome Nate Sumner.
Thank you. Jane, first of all, before I start, kudos to being a CSA member and signing up in January. That's awesome. You know, we find most people don't sign up for our CSA until it gets above 50 degrees. It's a little bit late for that to be as effective as it be. So, well done there. I'm going to switch this PowerPoint over real quick if I can remember how.
So, escape.
Yep, escape it. Done.
There you go. And now down to the bottom.
Going to the bottom. Boom. There it is. Now we're PowerPointing. Cool. All right, thank you guys for having me out tonight. Jane said, I grew up not far from Wheaton College. It's been a part of my life from pretty much as early as I can remember. And I think this is a really cool group, what you guys have going on here. I have for a long time been fascinated by all things science and the sciences in general. I think that finding out some of the keys to the answers or the mysteries of life is one of the more fascinating pursuits that one could have. So I'm really impressed by those of you who are in the scientific field. I have much respect for what you guys do. I myself, not a scientist at all. I don't. I admire you for it. Not my thing. But farming and cooking, that's where I can talk with a little bit of expertise on. Not too much, though, but I'll do what I can for you guys today. So I wanted to start by giving you guys a little bit of a, we're going to be talking about agriculture, different food production techniques that we use. But before we get that far, I want to talk a little bit about, just briefly, organic versus conventional farming. Because we can't really dive too deep into what I'm going to talk about without understanding a little bit of the main differences between the two. Conventional farming, what I mean by that is kind of the farming as we know it today, kind of agribusiness, if you will. Giant monocultures or thousands of acres where we're growing one crop. Obviously, I think we all know what it is around here, corn. Sometimes soy, but not even that much anymore. Heavy use of pesticides, heavy use of herbicides, heavy use of synthetic fertilizers, and now heavy use of genetically modified organisms. We're even genetically modifying plants with human genes now and that sort of thing. So that's what I talk, that's when I say conventional agriculture, that's what I'm talking about. And organic agriculture is a more natural, holistic way of growing things. There's no synthetics of any kind, very limited use of pesticides or herbicides, and really no sort of fertilizer can be involved at all. The primary difference, though, between organic farming and conventional farming is similar to almost like natural medicine versus modern medicine. You go to a doctor now, let's say, you got a headache, and they'll give you a Tylenol. Okay, so that's like a conventional farmer saying, oh, my corn's not growing. I'm going to give it nitrogen or, ammonia. That's not really addressing a problem. It's addressing a symptom. Organic farming is different. Organic farming would be, doctor, I got a headache. And they say, well, let's talk about that for a second. Let's figure out why you have a headache. Maybe you just need to relax. Maybe you need a massage. Maybe you need some natural remedy or something. But let's solve that problem besides just treating the symptom. It's a more holistic view of agriculture in general. So the other main difference is conventional farming treats the plant. Organic farming is going to treat the soil, the environment that the plant is in. Again, it's that holistic viewpoint. Conventional agriculture soils are treated nothing more than a mere media for holding synthetic inputs. It might as well be plastic little beads. It's dead, it's inert, there's no life in it. Organic farming, the soil is looked at as a life form unto itself. You treat the soil, you don't treat the plants. You feed the soil, you don't feed the plants. And what happens in organic farming is there's a interaction that occurs between thousands of microbes, there's minerals, there's humus and different types of sandy, silty loams or clay loams that mix together, form this web that's held together by mycelium and roots that have a pretty magical interaction. And this is where science gets cool, because I like to think of things as magical, but you guys know what's actually going on in there. And that's great, and that's what I love about science. And there's some crazy stuff that happens in there. For instance, a tomato root will go deep into the ground, and let's say that root that day needs some magnesium. Well, it's going to find the magnesium, but magnesium isn't really soluble in a form that a root can take up unless said root secretes an enzyme into the soil web that, while mixing with the other magic potions of the soil, again, I know it's not real magic, you guys know what I'm talking about, all of a sudden that magnesium becomes soluble and can come right up into that plant and give life to that plant. And that's where organic farming and organic agriculture takes place. It's not really treating it's not feeding a plant, it's encouraging life in that soil. And from that soil, life comes to the plants, and then we eat the plants, and then we get the life. It's this nice circle of happiness and love that we like. So that's the difference. I'm going to go ahead now and assume that we're all on the same page from this point forward, at least for the next 45 minutes, that we all agree organic agriculture sounds a lot better. Because it's the rest of what I'm talking about is not really going to work unless we're on that page. So at least join me there for now. And then, you know, if you want to talk about it later, there's like the mingle time. We can go at it up there. So I'm going to throw one more word out. I'd like to take credit for it, say that I made it up. I didn't, but it's called morganic. All right? Morganic is what I like to think of what we do at Heritage Prairie Farm. And that is taking these organic principles, but then pushing them to their limit to really see what kind of production that we can get out while working with Mother Nature, not necessarily working against her like we would with conventional agriculture, or letting her do all the work like we would in traditional organic agriculture. In more organic agriculture, it's a real team effort. We get to be a part of it. So that's pretty cool. But before we get too far into that, now that we have that baseline, organic good, more organic better, I'm going to go a little bit into my background, because I think it's cool that I get to be here in Wheaton, where I grew up. I love this town. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about Heritage Prairie Farm, just to give you some context about how we got ourselves into the situation we did with all this farming stuff going on. And then we'll get down to the nitty-gritty about the food production techniques and then what we get to do with them. So, like I said, I grew up not far. You guys are going to have to bear with me. Normally when I do these presentations, I'm usually like out in my muck boots in the field with a shovel. PowerPoint's a new thing for this farmer. Boom, there's a new picture, it's working. I just think this is pretty funny. Bottom left corner, that's where we are now. Top right corner, that's my house. So I grew up right there on North Path in the shadow of Traber Smith dorm. I think I actually measured it. It's about 300 yards. I just think that's pretty funny. So as you can imagine, just right down the street, my agriculture roots per se didn't run very deep. We never had a garden. Neither of my parents were farmers. My parents' parents were farmers. But I think that's pretty much true of anybody my age. So I don't think that gives me any special insights into the agriculture world. I did, however, get one pretty good outdoor plant working experience when I was in high school, and that was the one time I mowed the lawn right there. And that was it, because actually my dad really liked to mow the lawn, so I was pretty lucky that way as a high school kid. So I did do it once, and I did. So that was my green thumb for high school. So I did spend my time, instead of gardening like, you know, you would expect some farmers to do. While I was at school, I wasn't quite my appreciation for the sciences and what I really value, that the work you guys do, and other things like math and writing and reading. Those things didn't blossom yet. So in high school, I was more focused on music and art and photography and more of the creative, maybe we call them creative sciences, maybe? We can call them that, right? So I spent most of my time in the dark room or in the basement, bothering my very patient parents with my drumming. So I also hung out a lot here at Wheaton College. I did bring this for any old school people here. This is my original, circa, I don't know, 15 years ago, Crusader Crazies t-shirt. I know this doesn't exist anymore. Now you guys are the Wheaton Thunder. But I like this down the back. So this is, if anybody wanted, if there's like a Wheaton College Museum, they might want to keep this in. We can talk later about that. While I really enjoyed the creative life in high school, all my other friends were, you know, very studious. And while they all came here to learn, I did my learning elsewhere. And so I ended up spending some time traveling after high school, played music for a while. I was just kind of into cool stuff and decided, you know, I think San Francisco is pretty cool. I enjoy watching the Food Network. I could be a chef. So I ended up over here in San Francisco. I didn't really know what I was getting into. I wasn't really happy once I got there because I realized how serious this world was of culinary arts. But I decided, you know, whatever, I don't want to stick it out, go for it. And I immersed myself in this food world. And in San Francisco, it's probably the most developed local food system, small-scale agriculture system that we have in the country. In the Chicago area, specifically even north in Wisconsin, is starting to compete there, if you will. But San Francisco's got it down. Big powerhouse names like Alice Waters or Michael Pollan are out there. And so the movers and shakers. I mean, you guys go to a restaurant and it says, you know, if you go to any restaurant in Chicago, hopefully it says with Heritage Prairie Farm tomatoes on the menu. That didn't happen before Alice Waters decided that farmers should get credit for the work that they do. She was like literally the person who did it. And now every menu, every restaurant you go to, it says that. So it's kind of like a local food, center. So I got to know a lot of farmers there. My first job, I was out there as a prep cook at the Ferry Building. Is that good? I am at this PowerPoint already. Ferry Building is right here. This is the section, this is the center of the country's number one farmer's market. It's an amazing place. All inside there are restaurants and food stands. Every Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, and sometimes on Sunday, there's a huge farmer's market taking place out there. And the thing about San Francisco, where it's located, the type of food you can get there is, at any time of the year, you can have local, you know, and people are driving maybe 6 hours away, and I think that's still pretty local. You go 6 hours south, you can get local grapefruit, and you go 6 hours north, and you have local broccoli, or local Brussels sprouts, and get tomatoes from the south at the same time. So it's a really fun place to eat and a really fun place to cook. And it got me to start to think, like, farming actually exists. There are people that grow food. And I know, like, 10 of them now by name. I know who has the best strawberries when, who had the best grapefruit. She only came every other Thursday, so we had to stock up. You know, I mean, I got to have a personal relationship with some of these farmers and realize there was something bigger happening out there in agriculture. So I stayed there for a prep cook. I graduated. I came home because San Francisco was really expensive when, you know, you don't have your parents paying your rent because you're a student. So came home because I had to. And I started to try my hand at cooking out here in Chicago. Became very clear I wasn't going to be a cook. I was good at it, I'd like to think. But it was, you know, cooking, like farming, two things that either are going to fill up your soul, you leave uplifted, or it's going to tear you down, make you leave exhausted. Because I'm telling you, you know, now sometimes I'll get up at 3 in the morning, but when you're cooking, you're going to bed at 3 in the morning. And you have these really long hours. It's just a grind. And a grind is great when you're passionate about what you're doing, but I wasn't. So the chef pulled me aside one day and he said, you could tell I was struggling. He's like, Nate, do you really want my job someday? And I was like, yeah, I guess so. I mean, that's the ladder, right? And he said, well, if you do, you need to eat, drink, and sleep cooking. Every book you read needs to be about cooking. Every magazine you read needs to be about cooking. And on and on and on. I was like, well, that is not where I'm at all. Like, when I'm done cooking, I want to be done. So I realized it wasn't for me. So I was still a little bit lost. My wife and I were living in downtown Wheaton, right above Alpha Graphics. You guys know what I'm talking about. And we had a rooftop garden up there, a rooftop that became a garden after my wife gave me a few seeds one Easter. And I started growing them, and I was like, okay, this is cool. Really naively, I wanted to do it all organically. So there's pots existing there with soil, and I was assuming that it was bad soil, chemicals, you know, bad. So I dumped all the soil out over the roof into the dumpster, and then went to the hardware store and got topsoil and lugged up bag after bag after topsoil. A little bit lost. My wife and I were living in downtown Wheaton, right above Alpha Graphics. You guys know what I'm talking about. And we had a rooftop garden up there, a rooftop that became a garden after my wife gave me a few seeds one Easter. And I started growing them, and I was like, okay, this is cool. Really naively, I wanted to do it all organically. So there's pots existing there with soil, and I was assuming that it was bad soil, chemicals, you know, bad. So I dumped all the soil out over the roof into the dumpster, and then went to the hardware store and got topsoil, and lugged up bag after bag after topsoil, up to my apartment, onto my roof, and grew vegetables in topsoil with nothing else in it, just dead soil. So I got 2 tomatoes from 2 plants. But I was hooked, and I was ready to go. So that started my path on agriculture. The next year, I interned at the Green Earth Institute that Jane spoke so well of. I was second everything she said about that wonderful organization. And shortly after that, I ended up volunteering at Heritage Prairie Farm. It was the first year, 2008, and I really got to know some of the great farmers that were there. So there it is, Heritage Prairie Farm. Let me tell you a little bit about, now you know how I got to the farm, a little bit about how the farm came to be. Bronwyn Weaver and Bob Archibald started Heritage Prairie Farm simply because Bron loved bees. She's a beekeeper. It's her passion. She's crazy about them. And so she wanted to sell her honey. To sell honey, you need to have a commercial kitchen. So they built a commercial kitchen to sell honey, and they're like, okay, well, this is great. Now we need a place to sell it, so open a store on the farm. So now they have their bees, they have a kitchen, they have a store. Like, well, we should have more stuff in here, so we need to grow stuff. So they started growing stuff to sell in the store with stuff from the kitchen with the honeybees. And then they realized, well, we can only be open, for a few months a year like this, and we're not really getting too many vegetables in the store, so we need to talk to an expert. So they called a gentleman named Elliot Coleman, who is the small-scale organic farming guru of the world. He knows his stuff. So they call Elliot, and they're like, Elliot, we got a great project going outside of Chicago. Will you please help us out, to come out, consult on this project, and help us do what you do so well? And he said, no way, I'm way too busy for that. But the people that just run his farm had just moved to Chicago a few months earlier to work at the Botanic Gardens. His name is Mike Bollinger and Katie Prochaska, one of those two. So they call up Mike and Katie and say, hey, we got a great opportunity. We really want, we want to have a local, sustainable, organic, small-scale farm that we can grow things, and not just grow a lot of things off a small space, but be able to grow them and sell them throughout the year, not just, June through October, like most farms would do. So Mike and Katie said, well, this sounds like fun. So they came out and they implemented this system right here at the farm can get down and dirty and have grow a lot of vegetables in small scales, in a small space of, about 10, 12 months, depending on the season out of the year. A lot more has happened since then I'm going to get to, but first, since we're here, we're talking about vegetables, we're talking about food production, I'm just going to start right now into our food production and growing techniques. So Elliot Coleman came up with a lot of these ideas, but he certainly was not the original small-scale farmer. He's kind of led the charge in the rebirth of small-scale agriculture in America. However, where really the techniques that we use, that Elliot discovered, have their roots in Paris. As far back as 1670 in Versailles. The French take their food very seriously, as we all know, even though we now call them freedom fries, But the French they have very high standards for the food. And what else are the French known for besides great food is great wine? And I think that's an important thing to note real quick is that viticulture, which is growing of grapes for wine production. This is the wine industry is one of the last industries that actually appreciate what I'm talking about when I talk about the soil. They have a word for it, terroir, right? Yeah, if anybody's, you guys drink wine, all right? Okay, cool. So you guys know what I'm talking about, the terroir, where you can have the same grape grown in a different soil, in a different climate, and a experienced sommelier, if you will be able to taste that, and they can say, I can taste the terroir of that climate. And they'll come over here, same exact grape, same variety, nothing's different except the soil and the climate. They taste that, and they'll be able to know which region it came from based on the terroir, because the soil and the climate affects the flavor. And that's true of anything growing in the ground. But we just don't even realize that anymore. We don't think about it. We get a carrot, we call it a carrot. We don't know what variety it is, let alone where that variety was grown. It's just a carrot. Why do people get that still? And I think that they should be commended for it. So anyway, that's just my thing about wine. The French really cared about the quality of their food. They knew that their food quality was closely tied to the way it was produced or raised. So they invested a lot of time. In fact, it was a very high up position back in the 1600s to be the royal potager. Any French majors? No? Okay, good, because I'm not saying that right, I'm sure. So this guy's name was La Quintigny. French guy was the royal farmer. The royal gardener, in fact, is what it translates to. And he was growing food for the royal family at Versailles. And he was very innovative and started having some really rustic season extension techniques. And when I say season extension, that's what I'm talking about, taking, you know, manipulating the climate so that you can grow food at different times of the year. By the 1800s, those techniques had kind of been mastered by the Parisians in general. And by 1850, Paris, population of 1 million, was producing 100% of their vegetables within their own city walls. And they were doing it quite well. In fact, they did it so well that they started exporting it to London because they had a surplus. 1 million people inside Paris city walls, which I think is really, really impressive. Of course, everything back then was organic because we didn't know how to synthesize nitrogen. We didn't know how to take the from a dude and put it into a plant. Organic was just growing. It was just food. It was just how you did things. So how did the French market gardeners get so good at this? What did they do to be so productive in such a small scale space? They did three things. They manipulated the soil, they manipulated the plants themselves, and they manipulated the environment around the plants. When I talk about manipulating the soil, I don't mean, you know, manipulating, changing it, but I mean adding to it. Plants, obviously, we all know, pull up nutrients from the soil, and some plants put nutrients back in, or this is where we get more organic. We can help the soil along by adding some of those nutrients from other natural sources into it. So they heavily amended the soil. Oh, see, PowerPoint mistake. There we are. So these gentlemen here are some of I like to think of them as my farmer ancestors, the pioneers of small-scale, local, organic agriculture that we read about in every magazine today. And here they are carrying giant piles of poop on their backs. So this is one of the horse stables that was in Paris. I was told to use both screens, so we can look at this one too. And this is, you know, back then, primary mode of transportation, of course, was horses, carts, and buggies, that sort of thing. And they all pooped. The horses did. Still do today. And they would collect the manure in different city stables and carry it to add it to the to their soil to amend it. It wasn't just manure that they would use. Being relatively close to the ocean, they could go and get things like seaweed that has trace minerals from the ocean that, again, being farmers, didn't really know why it worked so well because they weren't scientists, but they knew it worked. So they went and gathered the, you know, green sand and, you know, seaweeds like kelp and would mix that with the soil, or excuse me, with the manure to create compost, and then add that to their soil. So they had super nutrient-dense soils, so they could grow an immense amount of vegetables and not deplete the nutrient levels in the soil, but actually be building it up. So even though you're pulling pounds and pounds of vegetables out of the ground, they are increasing the health and the life and the vitality of that soil. They would also manipulate the plants. Oh, real quick, almost forgot. 100 tons per acre of that stuff. That's a lot. It's a poop load. All right. Okay, let's see. PowerPoint. Boom. Okay, manipulating the environment. They would take... this is a picture here. It's a little interesting. First of all, let's notice a couple things. I already skipped a point. PowerPoint's got me all flustered. manipulating the plants, you can kind of see inside these plants here. These, I'm not sure what vegetables are growing under these bell jars here. It could be early tomatoes. It could be anything. But notice how closely they're planted together. Okay, so but normally a traditional mind would say, let's give the plant as much room as possible so it grows to be as big as possible. But what the French realized is that if you grow plants closer together, they might be smaller, but you get a whole lot more. So your net gain is significantly larger when you grow in dense conditions like that. There's also other things like pruning and that stuff that we'll talk about later. This is them manipulating the environment, though. This is their primitive greenhouse. These are bell jars that are covering plants that are growing. This is obviously pretty cool. You can see these guys seem fairly bundled up. I'm guessing this to be an early spring or late fall day. And they're tucking their plants away for a good night's rest. These bell jars, of course, cover one plant each every morning. Had to be leaned over and have a little prop of a stick up there to ventilate and not cook the plants because it would get very, very hot very, very fast. It's a small jar like that. And then at night they'd come and for each single one, they'd pull that stick out, cover that bell jar back up, and now it's going to trap the heat that was created in there during the day for the night so it doesn't die. That wasn't really enough though, so what they did is they had these mats that you can see rolled up here, this log right here, and they would unroll them over the bell jars to extra a double layer of insulation to keep those plants nice and warm. So they wouldn't, you know, these are frost tender plants, obviously, drops below 30 degrees. If they weren't doing this, they'd lose that entire crop. So, interestingly enough, backwards, oh, too far, boom, there it is, the poo pile. Also, really, really warm. The, you know, compost, as it's breaking down organic matter, can get, very, very high, over 100 degrees. And so when they amend the soil, they're also adding heat that's breaking down. They had these things called cold frames that were like large bell jars that were, or a box with a glass lid, and you would add the manure in there, and that supplemental heat would keep those plants warm too. So they were doing a lot of different things that way. So this is our ancestry of small-scale agriculture. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about how we do it now. This is Heritage Prairie Farm. That's Mike. That's Mike up there, my farming mentor. So how do we do it now? How do we translate what we used to do, what our Parisian forefathers did, to what we do now? Well, we do the same thing. We manipulate the soil, we manipulate the plants, and we manipulate the environment around the plants. We just do it in a little bit different way. First thing that will never change is amending the soil. Compost is the lifeblood of organic farming. It is the best way to increase fertility in your soil, increase that life that exists in that soil web that I was talking about before. So that doesn't change. What has changed is the type of compost we use. We now have lots of problems like E. coli or salmonella. You guys hear like, don't eat spinach or don't eat tomatoes. There's a salmonella on tomatoes. Well, that doesn't normally happen. That happened because someone put poop on that tomato, and we can't do that. So now we take compost, and compost now is a very specific method that has to be regulated by the government to make sure that it's what we call finished compost. So it goes through a process, kills the bacteria. It has to be heated up to a certain temperature, turned three times, heated back up to that temperature, held at that temperature for 3 days, then can be called compost. Then it's food safe. You can eat it, but I wouldn't. And this is the finished compost we use. When the time the compost gets to be this finished, we're now at about 16 tons per acre, down from 100. I would imagine the starting amount is probably the same, but once it breaks down into a more finer finished product, that's what we deal with now. But we also add the minerals. We also add the kelp. So if I buy it dehydrated in a jar, and I can grind it up and mix it into water and spray it onto my field. We use other minerals like lime. We need a lot of lime in our soil in this area. So we take it a little step further now, though, by doing extensive soil tests every single year. We go from plot to plot, looking at each plant soil area to find out exactly what's going on in there. Does a certain area need a little bit more of this mineral than that? And also, it's just good to make sure that we are maintaining that soil health. Because again, we're growing, we're treating soil, not treating plants. So make sure we pay attention to the soil. We also do a lot of crop rotations. Like I mentioned, each plant takes up a certain nutrient uptake from the ground, for instance, tomatoes will take up, we call them a heavy feeder, lots of nitrogen, lots of phosphorus. We grow tomatoes there again, we'll probably get by, we'll be okay, but we grow tomatoes there 3 years in a row, there's no more nitrogen or phosphorus in the ground. But there's other plants that will put nitrogen and phosphorus back in, and there's other things we can do by adding compost and minerals and putting it back into the soil to make up for that. So in a combination of amending the soil and making sure we stay on top of our crop rotations, we can really make sure we're not depleting our soil or abusing our soil. We manipulate our plants. Again, we have very, very dense plant spacing. This is a picture of one of our greenhouses. This row here, the red stuff in it, that's lettuce. The green stuff, that's lettuce too. The other green stuff is kale. The other green stuff is chard. And the little green stuff is ranch. We'll talk about that in a second. So our bed spacing is 30 inches wide. And this is where we talk about small scale, high production. This is really important. 30 inch wide bed spacing, 12 inch walking ways. There's been study after study after study done by farmer after farmer after farmer. Never really a scientist. This is farmers trying to figure out the best way to do it. And everybody pretty much agreed that the best, the most efficient use of space, notice I'm talking about space, not labor or time, the most efficient use of space is about a 30-inch bed with a 10 to 12-inch walkway. In a traditional growing method, even organic farming, still heavy use of machinery, you need a lot of room for machines to get around, you'll have 3 rows of lettuce in a 5 or 4 foot bed. And ours is just 30 inches. The pro to having all that space is that you can not have to pay people like me to go pull weeds out of there. But the con is that you need like 3 times as much space to grow the same amount of vegetables. So we have very dense plant spacing. This is Red Cross is the name of the variety. If any of you guys are home gardeners, Johnny, this is the best lettuce you'll ever have, I swear. The other thing, though, is something called multi-cropping. And so I'm going to use this one now. This line right here, right next to the lettuce, those are radishes. And this is called multi-cropping, where you can, take a little bit of unused space that lettuce doesn't really need when it's only 2 weeks old. And radishes will get to full size within 30 days of seeding. So that space can be used by the radish for 30 days, and then the plant will grow over, the lettuce will grow after 30 days as it gets larger, and then we'll use that space. So we're really kind of growing 2 crops in the same area at the same time, and that's kind of a fun way to get just a little bit extra plants out of the ground. We also do a lot of succession planting, which means that we never leave the soil bare. There's always something growing there, and that's really important. The other thing that we get to do is pruning. These are sun gold tomatoes. So pruning is really so we're really kind of growing 2 crops in the same area at the same time, and that's kind of a fun way to get just a little bit extra plants out of the ground. We also do a lot of succession planting, which means that we never leave the soil bare. There's always something growing there, and that's really important. The other thing that we get to do is pruning. These are sun gold tomatoes. So pruning is really special to me because I think it's kind of where we get to interact with the plants. I can control the size of a tomato. I can control the sweetness of the tomato. I can control the texture of the tomato, all by pruning and watering. And I can also decide how soon that tomato is going to be harvested or how late I want to harvest it by the way that we prune it. The same goes with garlic. This is garlic here. Those tall little stems sticking up there are called garlic scapes. Garlic is a funny plant because it thinks it can still make seed. It can't. It's been cultivated for man by thousands and thousands of years. It no longer has the ability to make seed on its own. It can only grow by a bulb, but it won't make a bulb until you rip that scape off because it's trying to go to seed there, and the plant freaks out and goes like, okay, red alert, we can't procreate through seed, even though you can't anyway, but they don't know that. So let's go ahead to plan B, which is make these big bulbs. And that's the garlic that we eat, those large bulbs. It won't make those large bulbs. It'll make little puny guys if it thinks it's going to procreate through seed. So that's another way that we can interact, manipulate the plants to get a larger yield from the soil. And of course, we also manipulate the environment. This is our spinach. I took this picture like 3 weeks ago. And this is our spinach that's growing in there. Remember those rye mats? We got a little bit more high tech. All right, so now we have Agribon. It's just a blanket. So we got a blanket there. We also have things called load tunnels. This is a really bad picture. It's the best picture I got of this. I'm sorry. But the those little hoops that you see over this beautiful, beautiful spring chard, actually it looks like fall chard, are low tunnels. They're temporary tunnels. Remember those bell jars that we looked at from France? This is our bell jar, except it's a lot easier than going to one plant at a time. We'll cover these rows with plastic or that Agrabond blanket, and it protects the environment the same way that those bell jars did before. Oh, man, I keep doing that. Boom, there it is. This is our greenhouse in the winter. And greenhouse is like a really big bell jar, covering a lot of plants at once. We can grow, in fact, today we harvested spinach inside one of our greenhouses. No supplemental heating, just the layers of plastic and the passive solar action of the sun warming it up. It's just like when, you know, we go on a road trip, my wife drives and I take a nap in the warm sunlight of the car because it's really warm and the sun passes through the windshield. It's just like that, except they're growing, not sleeping. So let's put this all together. Something special about that greenhouse I just showed you and these greenhouses that you see behind me, that they're all movable. We can literally jack them up, well, we pry them up, put some wheelbarrow tires on it, and just push it around back and forth. It's one of the funnest days on the farm because we get everybody out there. We get our chef out there, and you know, people from the office come out, and we all literally just push. And it's really, really simple. And when you have lots of people, it's very, very easy. When you have four people, it's nearly impossible. But we'll figure it out. So I'm going to do a little experiment here with you guys. It's a science word for you. We've got three positions that you can see here. We have three greenhouses, and there's the first position is A, the second position is B, third position is C. Our greenhouses are 30 feet wide by about 50 feet long, and they go over the position A, B, and C. And move. So we're going to look at an imaginary 30 by 150 space as three positions of a greenhouse and talk about what we can get out of that. Now first, just as like a baseline, conventional farmer, let's say they're growing tomatoes in a 30 by 150 space, is going to grow five rows of tomatoes. It's going to give them about, I wrote it down here, 750 pounds of tomatoes. Cool. 750 pounds of tomatoes. They're conventional, or even maybe they're organic, but they're outdoors, main season. They're probably going to be worth about $3 a pound if they're selling directly to the consumer, which is a whole other ballgame. So that's about $2,200 worth of tomatoes. Awesome. So let's talk about what we can do now. Position A. Let's say position A, we have the greenhouse there. We just pulled all the spinach out that was growing there before. We're not even going to count that stuff. We plant early carrots. Carrots, we plant them in February. They take a couple months to grow. We pull all those carrots out. That's going to be about 800 pounds of carrots. And then we're going to go ahead and plant head lettuce. Head lettuce takes about 2 months to grow. So they come out February, March. Plant them in May, June, July, August. They come out. And then that same place, we're going to plant peas. Now, why are we planting peas? Because peas can put nutrients back in the soil. They take nitrogen from the air, put it into the soil. Before we developed the same technology we used for the atomic bomb, there was no way that man could pull nitrogen from the air and put it into a solid form. The only thing that could do it was legumes, like peas or beans, and I'm pretty sure peanuts fell in that category too. Side note, I think it's an interesting note to say that man, the technology that man used to pull some nitrogen from the air has been used for mass destruction since its inception, and is still today being used for mass destruction, but not of our peoples directly, but of our soils, and then detrimenting health overall. It's a political thing, so I'll drop it. So that was position A. We got peas, carrots, lettuce. Let's go to position B. While the carrots were growing, we moved to greenhouse from position A to position B. It happened. I forgot to tell you about it. And position B, April 1st, we move it. The ground gets warm. It's now 80 degrees in there, even though it's only April 15th, because it's been warming up for 2 weeks. And we plant heirloom tomatoes. Cherry tomatoes are my favorite, so we're going to plant those. And those are going to stay there from April 15th. All the way through the end of October. We're going to start harvesting them. Our first marketable harvest always is and always will be 4th of July. It's about 6 to 8 weeks sooner than otherwise. And since they're so, you know, it's a much earlier harvest, I'm going to get twice as much per pound as my conventional friends who are just going to dump them on the market when everybody's got tomatoes. So that's going on. Meanwhile, in position C, in the spring, I planted arugula because it's one of my favorite spring greens, really spicy, nutty. So I'm going to get, oh, I forgot to tell you, that's 2,000 pounds of tomatoes, by the way, from the greenhouse. for the increased yields, pruning, pushing the yields, but pulling back on the water so I don't make them too mealy. There's a lot going on there. I don't have time for it. So we got 320 pounds of arugula. We're going to grow some beans, putting nutrients back in the soil, right? And beans are done about August. We got 600 pounds of them, by the way. And we're going to plant spinach there now. Spinach will go in by August. By the end of October, the greenhouse will move on top of that spinach that's in position C. And it's going to protect that spinach all winter long so that we can harvest it. Now, spinach in the winter is a delicacy. The plants have grown in a way that when the temperatures drop below freezing, they convert all the starch in the plants to sugars because it changes the crystalline structure of the juices so that when it freezes, it doesn't rupture the cell walls around it. That's science. Now, that sugar stays in the plant for, a good week, even if you harvest it or not. In fact, anybody know what the brick, we're all familiar with bricks. It's the measure of sugar in a solution. Lots of brewers or winemakers will read bricks counts of their fruit. So I borrowed my apple friend, growing friend's refractometer, and I squeezed spinach juice out with my bare hand, which is pretty cool. You can't do that with most spinach. And I held it up to the light, and it read a 13. And I asked him, so 13 on the bricks, that's pretty good, right? And he said, yeah, it's the same as my Honeycrisp apples. So, true delicacy. And it's really hard to find, so it's rare. So I get like $10, $12 a pound for it. It's another great thing about these greenhouses. So let's add it all up. These tomatoes, arugula, my favorite, beans, and winter spinach, the true delicacy of the Midwest. That's 5,000 pounds of food, valued at about $26,000. That's 7 times more food and 12 times more revenue from the same exact amount of space. That's pretty cool. So that's what we get to do with small-scale agriculture. That's why small-scale agriculture is going to be the future of agriculture if we're smart. But that's not really enough for us right now. That's not enough for, frankly, to be honest with you, to create a sustainable business. It's not really enough to have a sustainable future. It worked really well for the Parisians, but it hasn't worked that well for us. What has changed? Lots have changed. Here's an interesting stat. Early 1900s, food budget in America, 41% of household income was spent on food. Back in the 80s, that's down to 19. I like to be interactive. Does anybody want to guess what the average expert now recommends to home, like what home economists recommend spending on food? Anybody want to guess? This is the fun part. 10%? 10% is close. 10% is what we actually spend now, according to the USDA. But what home economists recommend is as low as 5%. That's how little we value food these days in American society. That's not going to work if we're going to have healthy, happy vegetables feeding our healthy, happy families. What else has changed? Interesting side note. I'm sorry to get political, but let's look at clothing. 17% in the early 1900s, down to 5%. Anybody want to guess why? It's cheaper because cotton is subsidized by the federal government. It is actually far more expensive to grow than what we pay for it. Same with corn, same with rice, soybeans, all that stuff. That's a whole nother talk. Did want to point that out, though. So what else has happened? People are busier. There people want convenience foods. People don't want to spend time cooking at home. People want to go out to eat and have a great meal. So Heritage Prairie Farm has had to adapt as a business to meet these modern needs of our evolving society. So first thing we did was we added the Community Support Agriculture Program, Heritage Prairie CSA. Super convenient way. If you have the time to take to cook at home, but you don't necessarily have the time to shop, CSAs are perfect for you. Each week, we start ours as early as May, go for a really long time through November for this to maximize the season extension stuff that we're talking about. And every single week, we pay up front. We get to buy seeds without having to take out a loan, which is really awesome. And so why it's important to do what Jane did and sign up early for a CSA. Don't wait till the last minute because then it doesn't really help us. So every week you get this box of fresh, delicious, organic, local food. Super convenient, a lot of fun. If you're a little adventurous in the kitchen, you're going to love it. What else do we got going on? We started growing microgreens. Microgreens are super nutrient-dense food. They're going to be the future of our nutrient supply in America and in the world. What is a microgreen? It's similar to a sprout, but it is grown differently. It's grown in organic soil, so it's pulling nutrients from the soil. That seed, by the way, the plant can live off just the energy in the seed for up to 2 weeks if it needs it. But when it's pulling nutrients from the soil, that energy stays within the plant. In fact, those two leaves that open up that look like little heart shapes, the first is called cotyledon. The cotyledon are like the camel's back. It's the energy store, right? Where the plant was growing in the wild and it germinated, but it was like in a crack of a sidewalk and it didn't rain for a few days and it needed some nutrients fast, it's going to pull them from those cotyledon. The cotyledon's going to die. You're going to see a little stalk come up and open one little flower to try to drop one seed. It's its last-ditch effort to continue its genetic life. Well, if the cotyledon's babied by being watered a few times a day and having the environment around it protected and the general love and care that we as farmers give them every day when we sing to them and talk to them, it's not going to use that energy. It's going to stay in the plant. Microgreens have 4 to 20 times more nutrients per square inch of plant than their full-size counterparts in the field. What you see here is microbroccoli, microkale, microcabbage, zuna, arugula, bok choy. That's all right here. It's all being grown. That's microgreens. Super simple stuff. Really tedious. It's like giving a haircut to a tray of dirt. We also started, we've continued innovating in our honey department. We started with honey was how the farm began, if you remember, in the beginning when I talked about bronze bees. We've now innovated more in this department. We now do honey infusions. We infuse honey with herbs, mint, rosemary, lavender. We infuse them with spices like cocoa and cinnamon. We got cute little packages. It's a little honey bear. You can buy a big old jug of it, too. The honey is a really important part of that local ecosystem that, we could do a whole nother talk just about bees. You can call me for that. We also got the chickens going on at the farm now. These are our heritage breed chickens, all sorts of different breeds. We use their manures to amend the soil in the field, just like our Parisian brethren did 200 years ago. They got cool little eggs, too. Those are blue. It's just this, cool blue eggs. The other cool thing that we got is we had a commercial kitchen on site. Remember I talked to you about that to do the honey? You know what else you can do besides honey in a commercial kitchen? Is food. So we now, it was always a part of it, but now we incorporate the kitchen and we kind of have this holistic thing going on the farm now where, we can start to plan out meals months in advance and amend the soils and grow the vegetables, just for an event or for a prepared thing. It's a slow food fast. Slow food is like, cooking food instead of buying a burger. Well, you can do slow food fast by coming to the farm and grabbing a prepackaged meal that Chef Nick over here prepared in the kitchen with the rest of the staff. Not only that, if you want to come out to the farm, we do pizza nights now. So you can come out, have a full meal with your family on the farm, not have to cook, not have to clean, but still get to take advantage of local great organic produce and ingredients. The biggest thing that we do is weddings. We have 40 weddings almost on the farm this year, all catered out of our kitchen, utilizing ingredients whenever possible straight from the farm. And we do farm dinners where you can come out to the farm once a month, have a meal prepared with ingredients straight from the farm. This is where it gets to be really, really cool. Nick and I have been talking about pizza sauce lately. We need like a couple hundred gallons of it or something for all these pizzas. And, this is where we can really tie in the holistic part of the growing, but we want to make the world's best tomato sauce. And we can do it. Nick's a great cook. He's going to come up with a great recipe. And those ingredients that we're going to come up with, we're working on right now. And we're going to harvest it in September. This is like 8 or 9 months out that we're working on this special sauce. Okay? And we can do it because I can pick out varieties and grow them in ways that are going to be perfect for sauce. Not all tomatoes are going to be great for sauce. Cherry tomatoes, not great for sauce. But what is going to be good is the Wisconsin 55 heirloom tomato that was bred right outside of Madison, Wisconsin about 80 years ago by Campbell's Soup to make great soup. It's got really bright acid and good texture. Black Rutula from Italy. It's a deep, dark mahogany black tomato. It's like this big, and it is deep, rich in molasses and brown sugar flavors. It's going to give a great depth and character to that pizza sauce. But it's a little dark, so we're going to lighten up with some color from the striped German tomato. It's another big, beefy tomato. It's going to be pink and yellow with stripes all in it. It's pretty cool. We're going to mix those together, get a good sauce, but those are all really, really juicy tomatoes. You don't want a juicy sauce. So we have to add some Amish paste and some opalca and some federales. These are all really great heirloom tomatoes that have really high flesh content, low seed content that's going to compensate for the extra juice that's in those other tomatoes. And then just to blend it all together and have a nice cohesive mouthfeel, we're going to add the green zebra tomato, another heirloom. It's about 60 years old from the Northeast. It's about this big, and it's super high in pectin, just the same stuff you would use to thicken a jam. And this pectin is going to give this tomato sauce a super luxurious mouthfeel. And this is the type of full circle farming and cooking that we get to do at the farm that you can't get anywhere in the world except every gardener's backyard, which I think is funny because I don't know if many home gardeners really realize what's at their fingertips. They're creating the world's best sauce in their own backyard. That's cool. So that's how we have, as a business, have evolved and adapted over time to work with the, you know, our great produce that we have from our Parisian ancestry. It's not, those answers are great though for Heritage Prairie Farm, but that's not going to be the answer to some of the bigger questions that you guys were talking about before with the hunger symposium that's coming up. Growing a lot of food off a small piece of land is cool. It's not rocket science. Proof is me, I've done it, and I'm not a rocket scientist. But it's getting a lot of food that you can grow in a small space of land to those hungry people that we were talking about before. And that's not going to happen until, you know, as a society, we kind of change some of our priorities on how we value food, how we value those who grow food. And as a country decide to support the different types of agriculture that we support. Are we going to invest our tax dollars into more monocultures and this big, large, efficient use of machines, but not space, and not health promoting agriculture? Or are we going to be able to start investing into some of these small-scale programs like what we've got going on and what hundreds of other farmers in the area are doing right now in small-scale agriculture? It's not going to be the answer to any of these problems that you guys are going to be talking about next week unless we can kind of shift our priorities. But it's totally possible. I just showed you how to do it, so that's not an excuse anymore. I guess that's what I got for you guys.
We certainly have time for a few questions, so if Nate's willing to entertain the questions, we'll go from there.
Yes.
Would you repeat where this farm is located in detail?
I will. Thank you for asking. It is in Elburn, Illinois, straight down Roosevelt Road, 2 miles west of Randall Road. The address is 2 North 308 Brundage Road. It's, the first left after Peck Road? Just outside of Geneva. So, you know, like 15, 20 minutes away. Open like 5 days a week, Wednesday through Sunday. Got some helpers over here.
What's the hours date that you could come
into
something?
Starting in April, 9 to 6, Tuesday through Sunday. Sunday's only 12 to 4. Starting in June, pizza nights every Thursday, except the Thursdays that we do farm dinners, which are once a month. All that information is available on our website, and there's some info cards up here on how you can get there and find that information.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes,
we have thought about it. It's an entirely different ballgame. Fruit. Right now, I kind of feel like we've got enough irons in the fire. We're doing a lot. But yeah, we do have some fruit trees that we use. It's a totally different ballgame. It requires a totally different education. It requires a totally different machinery and tools to use. So right now, it's not a part of our main growing business, but we do have some fruits and some cherries and some apples. It makes a really good cider and a cocktail too. So we do incorporate it. We've talked about incorporating it more, but right now it's not really a focus. But you can come to our store and buy some fruit from other local lighted farmers in the region. Yes?
So you had sort of implied, and I don't know if this is an incorrect inference, you certainly implied that basically if we're going to make this type of farming have the common thing in this country and make farming sustainable and actually be able to feed hungry people around the world, it seems like fundamentally food is going to cost more, that we're going to have to pay more for food. Now, is that correct? And if so, how much is it going to go up? We're paying 10% of our average family budget now. What ought that be in order to make sustainable agriculture future for us and the rest of the world?
Great question.
Question
was asked, if local agriculture and small-scale sustainable agriculture, was I implying that it was that if we're going to make it a sustainable part of our future, that we need to pay more money for it? And if so, how much more money? I think the word you used was, is it going to cost more, correct? Okay, so the reason I asked about that specific word is because I'm going to go ahead and say no. It's the true cost of what it takes to grow that food should not really change all that much. The reason why the cost at the grocery store is going to change is because right now, in the current system that we have as a country and a society, and it's not just America, it's mostly America, but it's other parts of the developed world as well, where the government will be, through subsidies, which serve a great purpose in a different era, are artificially lowering the cost of what it takes to grow food, or what it takes to buy food. And so farmers now are maybe getting money not from the consumer, but from subsidies and grants and all that sort of thing. And if that didn't exist, then the consumer would have to bear the true cost of what it costs to grow that food. So the cost won't change that much. But listen, Heritage Prairie Farm, We between all the stuff that we got going on, we'll have like 50 people on staff doing various things. Maybe in the area of food production for our little area here, maybe only full-time, seasonally, 7-8 people focused on that. Now, maybe 10 sometimes. That's a lot of people, and that's just... We need to pay a living wage. You know, these are hard-working people that deserve just as much money as anybody else doing a hard job. In fact, frankly, I think they deserve more, and that's not just because I'm one of them. And that's just the cost to keep these people employed. There's also equipment, seeds, all this stuff. So, it should cost more. We should make it a higher priority, and that's why... Back on that chart that I showed where we spent four times, 100 years ago, we spent four times more as a household on our food than we do now. I don't think it needs to go up that much, but yeah, I certainly think that we should be paying a lot more for our food because it costs that much for someone to grow it. I don't know the exact number, how much more. I'm going to go ahead and say double, at least. Other interesting note is if you look at things like entertainment and our budget for entertainment back in the 1920s, wasn't that big. Our budget for entertainment now is about the same size as our budget for housing. So I think we just need to reshift our priorities. I don't think that the more cost of food needs to translate to less money in the pocket of somebody. It's just a priority shift. Does that make sense?
I want to say the same lines in terms of talking about priority. The more you start looking into buying organic or sustainably grown foods, and you start eating these things and you realize how your health starts to improve, you're not eating all the pesticides, you're not eating the genetically modified organisms in these foods, and you start to realize, I need to stop taking certain medications because my health is better because I'm not eating these other things that are bad for me, is that people start to understand our society thrives on prescribing medications, and people start to eat healthier, they're going to realize they're probably not going to need to take all the medications taken previously, especially people who've been around longer and have, you know, developed more health issues, that it's somewhere along the line Americans need to look that food is, you know, your food, your nutrition is your medicine. That's your, if you eat the right things, you should be a lot healthier and therefore hopefully need a lot less pharmaceuticals. And our country, we've talked about how we feel like doctors keep prescribing band-aids for all the problems people have, but they're not getting to the root of the problem. What causes high blood pressure, you know, what causes diabetes, and a lot of it's based on diet and, you know, the lifestyle. So.
Sure. I would much rather pay a farmer than a pharmacist, right? The author of the Hippocratic Oath that all modern doctors have to swear by, Hippocrates, he said, "Let thy food be thy medicine." And I don't know where modern medicine, they left that part out of the oath, I think, but yeah.
What's the deal with you, like Jan's that she pays in January? What's
yes.
Sure.
There's a few ways you can do it. The easiest way is to just take one of these sign-up forms right here and sign up. So that's here now. But you can also call us, visit the website. But basically, we have three different options. You can do an early spring share. You can do the summer share. You can do a late fall share. You can do all three shares. You can add a share of eggs to it to get your local organic eggs every single week. You can even do a half share and just pick up every other week as long as it's at our farm. There's two places you can pick up. At our farm in Elburn, Illinois, it's a delightful excuse to come out and hang out in the country for a little bit. Maybe grab a cool drink from our store and sit out and enjoy the country life and pick up your produce and come home. However, it is a little far away to go every single week, I'll give you that. So we also drop off every Saturday morning at the Wheaton French Market, where we have a stand every single week right here in Wheaton. And you can not only come to buy our honey, our prepared foods, and our produce, but you can also pick up your CSA box there. Enrollment's happening right now. The sooner the better. It's starting to fill up a little bit. We did see a spike in CSA sales when we had that one day over 50 degrees recently. So if we can get more of those, we'll probably sell out pretty fast. There's all the information, the details beyond that are right up here. It's a really great way to incorporate local food into your daily diet on a regular basis. If you're not cooking at home a lot very often, I'm not going to lie, you're not going to use all the food. This is for people who are making meals from scratch, and that's why the farmer's market is a wonderful alternative.
What are your chickens fed?
Our chickens are fed a delicious, nutritious diet of microgreens, supplemented by certified organic grain, and they do have access even now in the dead of winter to outdoors. They don't like it as much, but they can choose to go out there. But in the season, they are also on pasture, so they're eating those nice little grubs in the soil, the insects, the most orange yolks you've ever seen on an egg in your entire life, because they're, you know, that's how eggs are supposed to be. So yeah, everything that is supplemented to their diet that's not of the direct earth or the microgreens that we feed them. Which is kind of, I mean, microgreens being fed to, I mean, microgreens are really, like, the best chefs in the world buy these things to sprinkle on their plates. And that's how much we value our chickens, that they're eating microgreens. But also certified organic feed, especially this time of year when it's, there's nothing happening outside. On the back.
I'd like you to address the partnership you have, because you can also buy meat at your location. And are your chickens going to be, are you going to have meat chickens?
Okay, meat chickens, you know what, totally more than likely eventually, because we end up doing a little bit of everything, so probably. I think these birds right now, poor Doug would never part with these. You know, Doug's our animal caretaker, and he's named them. There's Big Red. Philip is another one, so I don't think these birds are going anywhere. And yeah, we do, we have a store on site, so we don't specialize, we specialize in producing vegetables. Anything else, and honey, of course. But anything else that we do is done on a smaller scale, like the eggs. We sell our own eggs, but you know, right now we're only producing 40, 20 dozen a week. So that's not that much. So we have a great network of other local like-minded farmers in different areas that we work with. So that's where you can come to our store and get fruit. That's where you can come into our, excuse me, our store and get local meats. We've had elk in our store, grass-fed beef, pork, pastured chickens. all from the area, all meeting our same quality standards that we hold our vegetables and ourselves to. That's this type of stuff you can come and find in our store, and often dairy products as well.
So you've put out some fantastic ideas, of course, with the small, with the great spacing and the crop location and all that. How would a backyard farmer apply some kind of good soil amendment technique to get a better yield out of the garden?
Sure. Straight up, just compost is gonna. You'll see a huge difference. Of course, you want to be careful what you're buying because there's a lot of things that are marketed as compost that aren't. There's a great local product called Organimix that you can actually buy at Whole Foods. Oh, you can get our microgreens there too. Everybody, go check that out. They sell it at Whole Foods in the spring. It's a great amendment based on dairy composted dairy manure. There's any of the products that I use too. I mean, I'll go ahead and throw out a couple names, like Johnny Selected Seeds is a great company for, it's geared more towards what I'm doing in the commercial end of things, but they have an excellent selection of organic soil amendments, even things where we need when we see a nutrient problem in a plant, you need not just nutrients in the soil, but they need to be in balance, right? If they're not in balance, they're not accessible to the plant. So sometimes if we see a nutrient imbalance in the soil, and I need to zero in on a certain nutrient and get it in there as fast as possible in a water-soluble form. There's other, you would think of them as fertilizers, they're not. They're natural, but things like fish emulsion, which is like fish smoothie, and kelp meal, and those sort of things are all available from there. And you can totally do a soil sample. There's a company called Midwestern BioAg. It's $30. Dig a little soil up, send it to them in a bag, and they'll tell you exactly what you need in there.
What's the name of the
It's called Midwestern BioAg. I'm giving away all of our secrets here. Cool. This will be fun.
Some people might say that, our synthetic fertilizers have good things like the Green Revolution in India feeding a nation of billion people. Now, could they have done that without, or could they have done that with organic or more organic techniques?
Yes, they absolutely could have. The example that you brought up is particularly interesting, the Green Revolution in India, which is when there is a bunch of, India as a nation was starving, and companies like Monsanto or DuPont came in with their as the savior to the Indian people, and came in with their genetically modified food plants and their proprietary chemicals that are used to grow them. And yes, India saw a huge skyrocket in food production on a very short period of time. And all of a sudden, after the soils were dead, because there was nothing, the poisons had killed them, well, all of a sudden, Monsanto's prices just skyrocketed. And these farmers who had a surplus of food, so the food that they were selling has now plummeted in value. They couldn't sell it. They were in debt to a company already, and that company said back to the people in India, now that you need our stuff because you killed your soils and it's going to take you years to rebuild them, we're going to charge you double, triple what it's going to cost. And an entire industry went out of business overnight because of this. In fact, there's something called the Terminator gene that they introduced in India right at the turn of right when the Green Revolution was at its peak. And the Terminator gene causes sterile seed. So India, especially at the time a third world country, struggling to live. Also like my grandpa on my dad's side, hobbyists would save seeds. You take a tomato, this looks like a great tomato, I like the way this one tastes, I'm going to take this, save the seeds, grow that same tomato next year, save the seeds from that, and they would never even look at a seed catalog because it didn't exist, because they would just save seeds. A terminator gene terminates the vitality of that seed so that they're forced to buy that seed again year after year after year. Not only then, and this is the same story of the Green Revolution, the aftermath, did the Terminator gene exist, they also started to introduce seeds that wouldn't germinate unless they were sprayed by the proprietary spray sold by the same company that sold them the seed that's genetically modified to not germinate unless this chemical is introduced into it to have that reaction to germinate. And then you still need to fertilize the soil with the synthetics to kill all the weeds around it with the synthetics and to kill all the pests with the synthetics. That's something I didn't make a really good point of before. You don't really need pesticides if you have good, healthy organic soil. Elliot Coleman hasn't seen a cucumber beetle in 20 years. I see them all the time because we've just been doing this for like 3 years and it takes, you know, about 20 years of organic farming to get there, but you can get there. I've seen it before. So I would go ahead and counter the Green Revolution as an example of the success of modern conventional agriculture. And in fact, I'd go a step further and I would say it's probably the best example of how truly evil a company can be by manipulating people, taking advantage of them, killing their soils and their livelihoods. Thousands of people died after the aftermath of the Green Revolution. And to this day, still, there's entire areas of India that are barren that were once growing vegetables. So,
yeah. Hey, why don't we go for one or two more questions, and then we'll go to the reception.
A sort of related thing is a lot of stuff in the news the last few years about honeybees in trouble.
Sure.
Collapse. Have you seen that?
Yes. Generally, the colony collapse disorder is relegated to these large, super industrial commercial operations where they're taking honeybees on flatbed trucks and they're starting in Florida for the citrus harvest, trucking up through Georgia, hitting up the stone fruit, coming all the way up to Michigan, getting the cherries, and then going up to the northeast or the northwest and hitting the apple harvest, you know. So that's really, really hard on these plants. Additionally, apiculture, the cultivation of honeybees, is one of the country's dirtiest secrets. The chemicals that you're allowed to put on the food that we eat in a beehive are disgusting, and they're poison, and they're toxic. And so there's all this mystery about, oh, a colony collapse story, we don't understand what's going on. And it's like, well, maybe we'd have an idea if we stopped putting pure poison in there every single year. The chemicals they treat like things like mites that get into that are pests to honeybees are just this far away from killing the bees themselves. Just that one treatment, they'll do hundreds of them. So we haven't really seen the typical colony collapse disorder. We have seen areas where coincidentally a helicopter comes by and sprays the cornfield that's 100 yards away and it's a little bit windier than it's supposed to be. And then before you know it, all the hives that were on that fence line are dead the next day. So that's not colony collapse disorder. It's colony collapse disorder, the bees leave and they disappear and there's no trace of them. For us, we just open up a beehive and it reeks of dead bees. And that's, you know, because of the chemicals that are used. Bees also, real quick, I know we're almost out of time, but bees also feed their young a mixture of fermented honey, and they take wild yeast that's in the air to ferment the honey, and then that honey is what the young larvae eat to grow to become strong, healthy bees. One of the number one sprays used midsummer, which is when the second flush of new honeybees come in, are fungicides to kill fungal diseases on corn. And that's when we'll see the helicopter come by, and it's like Vietnam. And then yeast is, you know, it's like a fungus. It's a similar thing, right? And these fungicides kill the yeast that's in the air. The yeast doesn't exist to ferment the honey, to feed the larva, and we lose a whole generation of honeybees just from that one pass of the helicopter within a few hundred yards of our farm. So there's a lot going on in that department. Do we got time for one more?
Sure, let's do one more.
Anybody?
Along the same lines, how much of those pesticides are falling on your
yeah, that's a valid point. So organic rule of thumb is 30 feet barrier between an organic pasture and a conventional pasture. We took a look at our field. 30 feet's really close. So we keep a minimum of 50, anywhere between 50 and 100 feet away to keep the overdrift away. Also, I will say, as much as I've downplayed organic farming, I'm cool with organic farmers. We're all people, and we're in a similar industry, and they're nice guys. You know, they think I'm kind of crazy. They think we're kind of like witch doctors over on the organic farm. But they're nice guys, and so we talk to them and have a good relationship and say, when you do spray, we're doing it kind of differently over here. So they come out early in the morning, so the wind is almost dead, and we don't have any workers in the field, and they'll spray them. They're actually, we've had a really successful, happy relationship with them, even though I'm pretty sure they think I'm nuts.
Well, let's thank Nate one more time. Okay, are you able to hang with us for a few minutes upstairs?
Yeah, I can chill with you guys.
Okay, so if you've got more questions, Nate will be upstairs.
Thanks a lot.